That's what I really want to target in the paper is disinformation. So money will always affect things. Any money will affect anything, right? Any type of funding. But this sort of active use of things in this kind of merchants of doubt tobacco strategy of disinformation, that I think, so what I try to do in the paper is that you have to walk this really fine line if you don't want it to conflict with academic freedom, is you don't want it to be that it becomes whether you can get funding for your research hangs on a kind of political litmus test. Because, okay, if you have the politics I do, then the fossil fuel industry isn't like a shining example of awesomeness. But you always have to imagine that different people have different political views. And this sort of any kind of policy you come up with could be then also used against you or against your personal interest in some way. So, is there something that these companies are doing that's wrong? Well, you could say it's wrong without saying that it's because it's violating your conception of the social good. And so, yeah, on this kind of view, you again, I'm not pursuing this myself. I'm just going after the transparency. But if I were to go after this, then the way I would do it would be focusing on disinformation.
Hi, Greg. Thanks so much for being on the show today. It's really good to see you.
Hi, Andrea. Thanks a lot for having me.
So I usually start by asking, what's a moment in your life that you remember being moved, or some early memory that you have of motoring, or even a more recent one that's changed your idea of motoring? Anything come to mind?
Yeah, I guess maybe one or two things come to mind. One is, yeah, when I was a kid, I wish I could have called my mother and found out what type of car this was, but my grandfather was so proud of, he had this ancient car. It was like a 1940s something Ford.
Oh,
Can I
wow.
remember getting picked up and driven around in that thing. I
Yeah.
remember the feeling of the seats. Of course, there were no seat belts back then,
For
bouncing
those days.
around. I think those kind of safety rules get grandfathered often. And anyway, there were no seat belts in it, and you had great freedom there in the back seat if you were a little kid.
Yeah.
Bouncing around like that.
I
The
remember that.
car was awesome. It was just so cool. It was maybe, I don't know, 20, 30 years older than everything else on the road then.
Do you remember progressively the cars of your family and so
Oh
on?
yeah, I think I remember all the cars the families had. Most of them haven't been really very good, but
In what context have you thought about motoring over the course of your life? Like when do you think you started to think about what it actually means for the environment, for example?
Oh, yeah, I guess late adopter, everyone starts to realize the costs of what they do, and that kind of seeps into your life and different realizations here and there. Why? So I was just realizing, well, why am I using these plastic toothbrushes all the time? I could be buying bamboo ones or something. And I just realized this 2 weeks ago. And so you, why did I not realize it years ago? I don't know.
Yeah. Do you drive a car? Have you, through your adult life, always owned a car?
I've always driven right from 16. Yeah, I was chomping at the bit to drive. It meant getting freedom from your house and everything. Yeah, and I had one of the worst cars probably ever made, I think. I had the Plymouth Volare.
Oh.
It was boxy. It was Chrysler made those. It was like Chrysler made those K cars, and God, they were ugly. And this thing was terrible. And then I moved even further down from that. Then I had a Plymouth Horizon,
Wow.
which I remember the floorboard underneath the driver's seat had fallen through, and so I could see the ground
Oh, gosh.
as I was driving, and so I could actually do it. It was almost, and it failed so often that it really was tempting to turn it into a kind of Fred Flintstone car where you're running with your feet on the ground. That one also had this transmission problem that was awesome, which was coupled with some other thing where it would stall out if you didn't put a lot of gas into it when you started up.
Oh
But the transmission was really sketchy, and so when you put it in drive, you might have been in reverse or reverse drive,
Oh,
So you
no.
pump it with a lot of gas, but you didn't actually know which way you were going.
Oh,
You're gonna
God. That
go
sounds really
forward.
dangerous.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah.
They actually gave it away and lost money because I had to get towed away.
Oh.
The towing cost more than what I got for the car.
Did you still love these cars, even though you haven't described them as being very reliable or beautiful, but
No, I think the only car I loved, and then that had a major transmission issue too, was I did have a convertible Mini Cooper, something John, something, I don't know, whatever version that had fancy English leather
Oh,
seats,
yeah.
and it was beautiful. That was probably the only car I've had that I really like.
Did you take a lot of road trips? We're both from America, and there's this kind of road trip association. Did you do that much?
Not as a kid growing up. I'm from Rhode Island, very small. The idea of driving more than like 15 minutes is almost unthinkable. Didn't really
So
do
now you're in
anything like that.
California. That's a big drive from Rhode
Yeah.
Island.
And so now we will do these road trips, go up and see the national parks and Yosemite and or into Utah or something like that. And we're just at Joshua Tree a couple
Oh,
weeks
yeah.
ago. And
How was
well, that's
that?
a small road trip, but still somewhere deep inside of me is the original Rhode Islander who's thinking, oh my God, I can't believe I'm in a car this long.
Yeah, I remember we moved just like 30 minutes away from our sort of hometown, and going back to visit my grandparents, I just felt like it was like days and days when it was like half an hour.
Yeah.
You didn't
We were
drive
driving
much.
from Providence to the southern Rhode Island, and then I remember being at the beach and meeting kids, and they were all the way from Connecticut, and I thought, oh my God, I can't
Wow.
make a car that
That's funny. So you're a philosopher, so I there's something I think about a lot, but I'd love to get your perspective about the word motor itself, motoring. Just like maybe you can brainstorm a little or think with me about could we apply that word to any form of powered, like a unit that's generating movement power. We talk about electric motors, of course, but do you see where there might be a line, like a bicycle, for example?
Yeah, well, I guess loosely, I guess anything that produces work is a
Right.
motor, maybe. And
Yeah.
people do use it, like in sports, like in basketball or that, you might say, well, that person can't shoot, but he's got a he or she has got a strong motor, and so
Yeah.
they're very energetic out there.
Off, yeah. The motor system in the body. The word is used a lot.
So yeah, the other thing I meant thought of when you asked the original question is, I spend my life paddle boarding, and so then I think of, well, in that case then I'm the motor,
I was gonna
and
ask you about that.
that's
'Cause
really,
you do that in the mornings, right? Really early, or you live in San
yeah,
Diego. I guess we should tell
every
people.
3 or 4 days a week I go out, and then we, well, it's a bunch of us usually, and we go out and train for various races that are happening in California or elsewhere. So I'll be doing a race at the end of the month. I did a race, I think, a month ago.
So speed is important for you too.
And speed, and yeah, so you're motoring that thing, and you hope it, and there's, yeah, so I can remember the first time I got on a race board. So there's like your standard paddle boards where you're just floating around, and people with the paddle the wrong way. If it's stand up, they'll have a paddle. If it's prone, you just use your hands.
Okay.
But they're doing everything wrong, and they're just drifting around with the wind for blowing them around. But the race paddle board is a different story. You've got this carbon fiber, really thin, light, just an object of beauty. It's just really thin, so they're maximize the water line and get really and minimize the width, and so you can go fast. And I still remember the first time I got on one. There was this big race called Battle of the Paddle that used to happen. It was the biggest one in the world
Wow.
in at Dana Point. But all the vendors from all over the world would be there, and they would lend you their equipment so you could try it. And so
Oh.
then I remember I tried this bright red carbon Fanatic board, and
Oh yeah,
I
Fanatic.
just couldn't believe it. It was just so fast, all the water coming off the front. And I came in, and my daughter was with me, and she said, "Oh my God, Dad, you had white water flying off the front." And I said,
that
"I know, and I'm buying it."
the start of the racing?
Yeah.
Oh, so you, okay. Yeah. So really, it's very similar as in with other vehicles. Once you do it once, you want more and more. The sensation of speed, I guess it's not that different from depending what kind of instrument or vehicle we use, it's still giving us a similar feeling. But I don't know, do you feel free when you're on those boards? Is that part of the
Oh
draw in the
yeah.
same way it would be with a car or a bike?
Yeah, that's funny because you do feel like you're going fast sometimes, and really you're going very slow.
Comparatively, I
If
guess,
you're
too.
doing a race, if you're a racer, you're trying to hold. To have some self-respect, you're trying to hold that board over 5 miles an hour. Like six is like really very, very, very hard to hold. You can't really hold it for a whole race. And so you go
Wow.
very so slow.
Sounds very
But
sweet.
on a
5 or 6
pro board, it
miles
feels
per
so fast because your face is down on the board. And
Mm.
then you see all those little waves going by and you feel like you're flying. And then
Yeah.
you look and you're going only 5 miles an hour.
Yeah, but you can feel like that. I remember feeling like that as a kid on a like just a wave board catching a wave and who knows what. So, yeah. I'd like to hear when you did, we didn't get quite to the question, but when did you start to think about your motoring choice, or do you think about your choice of car? I assume you still have a car now. Do you still have a car now?
Yes, and yeah, I have the traditional car of the professor, which is the gas-guzzling Volvo,
Ah, the Volvo.
and we have a Prius. But yeah, maybe this summer I get an electric car. But yeah, I have definitely started, well, especially in the last few years, been thinking about it a lot, and so now the Volvo has been relegated to basically becoming a paddleboard car to transport my massive paddleboard. And
Okay.
then when I'm going to campus and things, if the light and temperature work out, then I'm taking an electric bike.
Oh,
So,
okay. So you bike to work?
well, just the electric bike, so it's not
Yeah.
really like real
Oh,
biking.
yeah.
But
Well, in terms of the environment or in terms of the use of fossil fuels, it's very different.
yeah, it's great. And it's amazing the transformation around. It's highly non-uniform, I think, in the US, but like in my town, there's just armies of people on e-bikes everywhere.
Oh, really?
I saw some study that said that the e-bikes have saved something like more like 4 times as much as EV cars so far.
That's ex
I
that's
don't know.
inspiring.
I don't know. I can't vouch for it because I'm really not an expert and didn't study it, but that doesn't surprise me. I think of all these high schools all across the US, you just see armies of e-bikes, and those all would have been parents or kids driving their kids back and forth. So all those trips have all been they're gone.
Yeah. How, when has that change started? You've lived there quite a while. So is that just in the past couple years, would you say, or is
Yeah,
it?
I'd say the last 3, 4 years. I did start thinking more ecologically about cars, and this will get into one of the topics we'll end up talking about, but yeah, in the mid, well, like 2000, I guess 2015 or something like that, 14. Then the two cars we had were a Prius and the Volkswagen, the TDI Sport Wagon. And then it had such good mileage. So that was before all the EVs started hitting the marketplace. And so then I thought at the time, I thought, oh, I'm about as good as you can be because I had these two cars, which both had extremely good mileage. The Prius and the TDI Sport Wagon. And then, of course, we know then what happened with the Volkswagen Dieselgate.
Yes.
But at the
So
time, I thought, oh, I'm on this clean diesel and I'm getting 40 something miles per gallon. And the Prius is about the same, I think. And I thought, oh, this is really good.
did you and your family choose the Prius and the Volkswagen TDI diesel wagon for reasons of gas consumption mostly, or were you already thinking about the environment, or was it both? Because we have to remind people that was the time when we Volkswagen was saying that these were clean diesel cars. So it was being marketed as something that was good for the world, but also good on gas mileage. So
Yeah, I think it would be hard to tease apart the different factors in the decision, but it would have been a bit of both.
You were already thinking about all that, is what I guess I was getting
A
at. 'Cause
little bit,
that's,
yeah,
yeah.
not as much as now. I should have been thinking about it more, but I wasn't.
Most of us weren't, weirdly. It's only like 10 years ago, but it's changed a lot.
Yeah, you can see it even in the so it now there's all this push against carbon neutrality. So back then you weren't really thinking about just cutting CO2 source of emissions. You were just thinking about scaling them back a little bit, and then you would get hopefully you could get to something like carbon neutrality. Now carbon neutrality seems like a kind of accounting trick usually, and you want let's you think, well, let's just cut the emissions and just go electric. But back then we weren't really thinking that way. So you
No.
see a lot of shifts in people's thinking now. So the University
Yeah.
of California just finally, they were supposed to be carbon neutral by next year, but emissions on every single campus just keeps going up, more or less. And how are they going to achieve carbon neutrality? They were going to spend $20 to $30 million a year on carbon offsets. And so it was really more like an accounting trick than an actual emissions reduction.
Yeah.
Like you say, back then we weren't really thinking in terms of just cutting emissions. It was more about reducing.
Yeah, it was before there were a million programs for how to offset your carbon footprint. Now it's like you can almost feels like you could just use the car as much as you want so long as you do something to offset your carbon. But back then that was kind of a new idea and it didn't seem like a trick at all. It seemed and it wasn't a trick. It was a way of trying to get people to realize what they were doing and think about it, but now it's become a whole business of how to offset your carbon footprint.
But the offsetting is, I would argue, ethically sketchy, and ultimately gets used as a reason to drill more and to emit more.
So, what is the university? What did they decide to do?
But they have more emission reduction targets now. So the committee I work on, we push this memorial through to the regents all the way through the whole campus system, all 10 campuses, and the faculty voted 85, 86% in favor of it. And it asked for 60% reduction by 2030, 90 or 95% reduction by 2035. The university responded and did not get anywhere near those numbers, which is unfortunate. But on the other hand, they are scrapping the buying your way out of it through offset.
What's the committee that you're on? Is that the campus climate change or what is it called?
Yeah, so CCC, Campus Climate Change
Okay.
Committee, and it's the only standing academic senate committee on climate change in the UC system. Though we're hoping that other campuses will follow us.
Did you
Because
start it? Did you start that
we've
program? Were you
done a
part
lot.
of
No,
it?
but I was on the inaugural team. So the great climate scientist Ramathadan chaired it first, I think 4 years ago. And then it's been pretty amazing what we've been doing because we had that big thing. And then we just had passed, and it starts in September, a climate change education for all requirement. So every student will have to take some kind of
Oh.
course on climate change.
Is that new? Has any other university ever done that?
No, it was just written up a little bit in the Chronicle for Higher Education. And they couldn't think of any other school that has done it. So I think we're the first. And then we're hoping to push it or encourage other campuses to do it. And yeah, it's amazing, really, when you think about it, because this little committee ended up started this, and it took a long time. But the end result is that next year and for every year after at UCSD, so UCSD has 42,000 students, all 42,000 are going to end up taking this, but 42 includes the grad students. So I think it's probably 7, 8,000 undergrads will end up taking this per year. And so if you then think of other campuses, by the time I'm retired or dead, hopefully hundreds of thousands of students will have taken such a course that otherwise wouldn't have taken.
That's really a huge change. How big is this committee and how did you all come together? Who started it? It wasn't, Was it initiated by individuals?
Yeah, there are all these climate activists on campus, and especially Adam Aron in psychology, and they got this kind of Senate task force on climate change. And then one of the recommendations was the formation of this committee. And then we've been doing that. And then we've been doing another project. Well, we have a bunch of projects, but one is also on that connects up with some of this kind of industry bias stuff that you get with Volkswagen. It's basically a kind of funding disclosure policy. Industry can be a great partner for the university, but also something we know that studies funded by industry tend to be favorable to industry. That's been demonstrated many, many, many times. And the work that gets produced often is used for things that are contrary to the public good.
So you're talking about like big oil companies funding research, like BP or something, or we
were
invested in, and that's a huge, that's billions of dollars, right? You've actually written some really articulate papers about this. So I wanted to talk to you. It's one reason I wanted to have you on the show. I'll definitely link to all that. But for people who haven't even ever thought about this, as a professor, as an academic, you often need, like, the university needs funding, right? And a lot of this money comes from these big companies, which are often something like a company that's making money on fossil fuels, right?
Yeah.
But nobody knows it, that that's where the money is coming from.
Yeah, sometimes it's not known, sometimes it's not disclosed. And then that allows that work to be used in various ways. So the university needs money from the outside. You know, so if we stepped way, way, way back, University of California, well, it was a state public school. In 1980, I believe roughly 80% of its budget was paid for by the state.
Oh,
fast forward to now, and I think it's more like 12%. But it dropped so, so, so much. And so the university, to be a great university, needs to make up the gap. And so all these kind of industry partnerships and stuff like that happen. Some of them are huge, though. 2009, I'm guessing, maybe 8, BP, British Petroleum, gave this consortium led by Berkeley a half of $1 billion for an energy institute.
Wow.
And so that's a huge, just absolutely massive sum. This is happening all over the U.S., and it does happen to some extent outside the U.S., but of course in Europe where you are, it still happens. Like VW is massively influential in German universities.
Yeah, and also in the arts, or there's lots of things that are funded by that, which ends up being educational. But
and it's not just that people think that these companies are giving hundreds of millions of dollars just for greenwashing or ethics washing. So BP's got their, when you look, go to a gas station, it's all like green forest or something. They're trying to literally greenwash you. But if you think that they're giving that much money for that, then it's naive, because I give an example of what's the power of this. So they could give money, and they have, to there's a MIT Energy Institute, and they famously produced this document called The Future of Natural Gas. And they were heavily conflicted. So they disclosed one conflict of interest or one funder, but they didn't disclose most of them. So almost all the authors were tied to really the biggest, gas producers in the world, and even had positions, not just, so they're financially conflicted, they're organizationally and positionally conflicted. None of that is mentioned in the thing. That report, though, now it gets used when they go to Allegheny County and say, hey, can you open up such and such a place for fracking? They then say, well, it's not just us, the fossil fuel company. It's also these independent experts at MIT are calling for. So this gets used again, 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 again. And you can even trace language from it all the way up into Obama's 2014 State of the Union address. And then his choice of energy secretary was the author of this report. And so that, I wouldn't say that that report caused the fracking revolution in the US, but it was a part of it anyway. And so when they're giving all this money, that's what they're getting, is this kind of research that ends up shaping policy.
It's
Because
like
they're actually shaping
undercover or
policy.
something.
Sorry?
It's kind of undercover because greenwashing, we just want to think that they're doing things for the environment to help the environment, or they're changing their behaviors in order to be more sustainable, which is something else. But this is literally funding huge research studies, but without disclosing necessarily that those studies, when they're done, which are done really well, as you point out in your work, they can be really good studies. But they're coming from a frame of being funded by these companies. And then the study itself might say, yes, it's good to do A, B, and C to fracking, for example, because of this and this and this. And it's presented in a very scientific way and scientific language with actually real good research, which is what's so confusing. So then other people see, oh, they can cite these papers. So it becomes a matter of thinking it's science, and that the science is supposed to be separate from the company, but it's not. So it becomes very complex, right?
Yeah, and so they have this clear, so you could think of, some of it is just kind of image reputation management. So Exxon used to fund the Sally Ryder Academy. This is, was like a thing that you would send, so it was of girls in STEM program. And so Sally Ryder is the famous astronaut. And so your daughter wants to become an astronaut, and then they go to this camp. And it's the Sally Ryder Academy brought to you by Exxon. And
Right.
so they're not getting any kind of policy product from that. That's just kind of image management. But this other thing I'm talking about is really like the manufacturing of a kind of manufacturing of science and of policy that ends up having, making a big difference in the world.
Yeah, you have someone like Obama who I think a lot of people would just generalize as against this sort of thing, especially back in at that time. And so then it becomes very confusing to think that he was citing a report that was funded by kind of the people that he's campaigned on reining in, which is a common pattern
Yeah,
that
he
you
might
point
not have even
out. Yeah.
known, because it wasn't disclosed. And so that's why I've been pushing for at least disclosure. And then you could look and see, is the work good or not good?
And why
Is it
don't
tilted?
people disclose? You talk about sunshine, right? Like why shouldn't it just be standard that universities have to disclose where the funding comes from? I believe you said in your article that no one discloses all
Yeah, I don't
funding.
believe any university has a completely general disclosure policy. So if you take, so in the US, if you take federal money from the big funders like NIH and NSF, all that gets disclosed. So a lot of things automatically get disclosed. But, and then also you're always disclosing privately to the university so they can take a cut of the money to pay for the lights and the building and all of that. So the universities know exactly what everyone is, but none of it's, but a lot of it isn't public. And so for instance, so I, the, our, the institute I run, the Institute for Practical Ethics, I received a gift from the Reed family, but I don't have to disclose that. And it was nothing, there's nothing that makes me publicly disclose that. And so if we replace them, but suppose it was Exxon, then, well, it'd be a little odd if all of the publications from the Institute for Practical Ethics all turned out to be Exxon friendly, but there's nothing stopping that.
Yeah, but so you most like just in general, if I want to read, if I read a paper, if I read that paper, if I'm trying to figure out is fracking okay for the environment and I read these papers, there's really no way I would ever know who funded it, right? I can't
No.
find out.
No.
Yeah. So that's what you're saying is that should be easy to
I
find
think
out.
that should be standard. Yeah. And so I think what happened is, after, so there were many, many scandals with big pharma. If we dial back 10, 15 years, but well, you could probably find any a scandal in any year, but
Yeah.
some high profile ones that then led to this transformation in biomedical research where they really disclose everything. So You go to a talk, and the last slide of the PowerPoint is thanks to, it's like Merck, Pfizer, all those things. And it's all there. You go to a lab website and you see it, and it's all, and all the journals, they're very strict. They're probably like the gold standard for transparency, the biomedical journals. And but then if you switch into the energy world, that's not going to be the case. You might not have to disclose that the journals, that your website does not disclose. And then since no one is forcing anyone to disclose, that's when this kind of so-called dark money can then work, because they can then influence you. And again, the research might not be good. It might not be bad at all, right? Because they can selectively pick who they fund and who they don't fund. So they can do what the tobacco companies did. So they would fund other causes of lung cancer apart from, so does asbestos cause lung cancer? And they could fund a really good study on that. And that makes, it'll sort of distort the evidential landscape, because now there's all this, all these other causes of lung cancer, when really the smoking was the main thing.
Right. So you get all these studies about lung cancer being caused by A, B, and C, not smoking. And so all that stuff gets talked about and cited and so on. And in this case,
That's
it could
right.
be something like a lot of studies done on why electric energy sources are as bad when it comes to your carbon footprint as other things. Like maybe that could be funded, and then you would focus on that or something.
Yeah.
But you were talking about the medical thing. Has it changed the funding and the framing of research now that you have to disclose it all?
Yeah, that's why I keep saying, you know, I don't believe it has. And so when I, when public disclosure meets resistance, they say, well, this is going to be the end of our field. There won't be as much funding. There'll be all these different problems. The sky is going to fall. But then if they say this, and there's somebody from biomedical research in the room, they say, they'll point out, well, no, it hasn't.
It hasn't changed much.
But it's not like biomedicine died in the last 10 years because they had to disclose. They didn't. They've thrived, really.
Yeah. So you're saying everything should be disclosed. It might not necessarily change the problem, but we haven't really talked about the problem, talking about all these oil companies or big car companies as if they're evil or bad or something. And that's also not, that's a bit of a caricature too, because we're all participating in this. So I'm wondering, how did the universities get so tied up in motoring? And do you really think that this fossil fuel world is as unhealthy as the tobacco industry, and that it really is now the tobacco of today in terms of what it's doing, not only in terms of in the universities funding things that are taking attention away from their own issues or funding things that will help them, but also just actually lying and presenting a view. Like it was once said that tobacco is healthy and that smoking is good for you. And there are all these kind of doctors even saying, yes, a cigarette a day is good. So is this, are we in the same situation when it comes to this whole fossil fuel world, which can't be disconnected from all these huge companies and all the cars we're driving? And
yeah, I think we're in exactly the same situation, except far worse, because, well, tobacco, it's estimated it killed 100 million people in the last century, so that's a lot. But of course, climate change is worse. And then these companies are also, I would say, behaving, some of them are behaving just as badly or worse than the worst offenders of tobacco. And so it's always about delaying any kind of anything that will reduce emissions. And so you'll have the creation of all these kind of bogus concepts, net zero oil and things like that. But you'll also have the attacks on scientists, attacks on, they can ruin people's lives. They have effectively infinite money, really, because they're so profitable, and they can do a lot. They can manufacture science. They can capture regulatory agencies. They can create journals. They can create societies. They can do everything tobacco did and more, because they have even more money. And then it's even worse because the stakes are higher.
Do you think the truth has come out about the tobacco, and do you think the truth will come out about fossil fuels?
Yep, I do. I think in both cases, it's a little different because we had the massive tobacco lawsuits and then eventually the big settlement in the US. And right now you have many climate lawsuits happening. But of course, it's harder to prove causation with a particular kind of harm and link it to climate change. But that's where there has been a lot of work on that. So there's the Climate Attribution Center at Oxford. They will like give them a massive weather event. So all the flooding on the East Coast right now, and you tell them how much of this was, what percentage of this, what was the percent causal responsibility due to causal climate change of this? And then they'll say 33% or something. And so this stuff is getting more sophisticated. It will get, and the climate litigation stuff is more sophisticated. And so all these lawsuits all over the, I think there's about six of them in California, plus the one by the state of California. The fossil fuel is fighting these really heavily because they're worried that if one goes against them, then others will follow, and then there'll be a kind of avalanche of groups finding a way to successfully prosecute them for some of their actions. So I think it is a matter of time before one of these lawsuits goes against them, and then we'll see. But yeah, you could go to, and you could look at all the incriminating documents. If you go to industry documents, maybe .ucsf.edu, or maybe it's just industrydocuments.org. Anyway, okay. It's University of California, San Francisco houses 14 million tobacco documents and some many, many, many documents on climate, showing that they knew what they were doing. That's been the most interesting thing really being revealed in the last few years is, and of course, these scientists at Exxon, some of them are great scientists. And to see how well they nailed climate change predictions back in the 90s. So there's all these documents where you can see they knew what was going on, and they knew as well as the climate scientists who weren't working for them. They basically nailed it. It's amazing to see the graphs and lay them up against the what actually happened since then. So there you have some hard evidence that they knew exactly what they were doing.
So they already saw that we were going to get to this place where we are now, which is a place where it's almost, we don't know how, we feel like almost helpless, but we're not. Yeah. And there's stuff we can do, and we are doing it. But basically we knew that decades ago, but it was all not presented as the truth.
Yeah. So I don't know what we're at like today, but on the Keeling curve, I think we're probably like at 18 parts per million. And I think if you look at what Exxon predicted for this year, for what we would see as we're having this conversation, they were like pretty darn close.
Oh, that's just so frustrating. It's so
they knew it, and then they of course tried to cover it all up. And then attack scientists would produce that same work. They would attack them, even though they knew it was right.
Do you think that could be at some point considered criminal?
Yeah, that's why I think this will end up getting, this will end up in some litigation.
So that people could actually get prosecuted against as individuals, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know about it, whether individual or just, or I don't know how exactly that works for the company itself.
Yeah, I guess it's just, it's hard for me to see how we shift the cognitive landscape relative to all this. And maybe we can talk too a little bit about how we understand our own sort of position in it, in terms of just like just saying, okay, corporations are bad and oil companies are bad, people can say that, but you're still smoking. You're still using the cars. You're still you taking the money for your
I've got
research,
that gas
and
guzzling
then,
Volvo, old Volvo.
yeah, I just rented a car. It's an ICE. It's in an internal combustion engine because I got rid of my car, but I still have to rent cars all the time. I don't have to. I could take a million buses and get somewhere, but we're moving house and you need. So I guess what I'm trying to first get at is, there's been a call, for example, for a ban on all fossil fuel research money being used in universities. And you've written about this. And is that kind of like the, is that, how do you see that as a step towards starting to change this overall understanding of the connections between all these parts? Because really it comes down to individuals changing their habits, but through something like funding research, perhaps, I don't know what you think, we learn our habits or what we should have as habits. So for me, it's very like, where do you get into this weird circle and start to change things? Do you think this ban on all fossil fuel research could do something like that, or would it also just be another good try, but not much change?
I think of all these things as just like little pieces. So maybe being the age I am, I always think about the tobacco case. So I grew up and lots of people smoked, lots of friends smoked. I lived with a smoker. It was just part of life. And then you would start to see all of a sudden at certain cafeterias, you would see these screens and the smokers had to sit over there and then the non-smokers there. Eventually they're booted out of the, you couldn't smoke inside. And then I think, so you had all these little rules. So did putting up a glass screen in a cafeteria and making the smokers sit on one side and the non-smokers on the other, did that really like change things? No, did not, probably almost nothing. But what I think happens is eventually if you enact some of these things, the kind of social norms change. And so when we then think about tobacco using the so-called tobacco strategy to manipulate academia, why did, so now how many schools actually banned it? When I count them, I can only find like maybe 15. So most of them did not ban tobacco money
Interesting.
for public. It's like Harvard Public Health and Medicine did in maybe 2002, 2004, and then it got a lot of attention, but most of them didn't. So why is there not that much tobacco money? Well, some of it's coming back, but why is there not that much tobacco money funding research in US universities anymore? I think basically the answer is because it became not so cool to say in the faculty club, my lab is funded by Marlboro. That then became not a very cool. Are students attracted to work in that lab? Are you're now facing these kind of social norms? So I think that would happen with fossil fuel money as well. It's not going to be so cool to have your climate center, funded by, that's teaching students about the climate crisis. It's not going to be so cool to have those things all funded by Exxon, especially given
No.
what we know, that they're not getting nothing for the money.
It's not so cool now. It's you just don't know. I guess it that's kind of part of the sunshine idea of yours. If
That's
it
right.
was if it was clearer, it would already not be so cool. It's just it all gets pushed away and in the inertia of over information, and you would have to go really, really dig for it, and no one has the time to do that. So yeah, if it was just clear and there, it could be change. But I think what you're saying is really interesting about the smoking and the habits and the that it actually starts in an interesting way, because that's true. Like you used to could smoke in all kind of bars and stuff, like in Berlin, not that long ago when I was studying the first for my first degree, and then it changed and it's just not cool anymore to smoke, and you don't feel people don't want it around anymore. But when those things first happened, it was like, oh, big against our freedom and all of this. And then but now it's like no one would choose to have a bar that's full of smoke, because you realize how disgusting it feels because you've had the opposite. So Maybe something like that is starting to happen now, but do you see that as like a, is that still a government initiated change? Like that we decide you can't smoke in public spaces and all this stuff that you described. What's that interplay, right? Because people didn't just decide they don't want to smoke in bars. They never probably would have. Or did they? I don't know.
Yeah, and if government enacted something where there wasn't already some kind of groundswell, or at least a significant amount of people who are willing, who accepted that, then it probably wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, and there probably were a lot of studies by then showing what the real truth was about. You couldn't avoid the truth anymore that tobacco was killing people, so that you're killing innocent people who don't even smoke but are around it.
It's just
What's
absolutely amazing to me how successful that tobacco strategy was, because in the US, it was the Surgeon General announced that it was causing cancer, I think, in 1964. It was known already to scientists, and again, tobacco scientists, much earlier, probably early 50s, or if not earlier. And yet they were still getting subsidies from the US government in the early 2000s. And so we were subsidizing a thing that was killing us. And so there's all this kind of delay tactics that worked for decades. It's just amazing.
which is another parallel to what's happening with oil companies and so on, because there's a few philosophical theories, right? I can't remember, like John, J the Johns, I think John Nolte maybe, or Nolte and John Brown. There's been these kind of philosophical ideas that say that the way we act as individuals just are, or as a Westerner, I guess, too, would have to be that your patterns of emission actually result in deaths. This is one theory, I think, or that it takes time off of the average lifespan, even for people who never use anything that has emissions. So I guess I'm wondering, has anything been applied like that to companies philosophically? Like that.
I don't know, but you could imagine looking at, I don't know if this is what you're thinking, but I guess you could imagine, take some company like Exxon and then see, I don't know how you like imagine how much ex how excessive their production is in some way. Just take
Data they
the
had.
social cost of carbon and just
Yeah.
multiply that by something, and then see what the true cost is up there. This is what it's all about, really, is that they've externalized all their, they don't put into their price the social impact of what the harms that they're sending out.
They don't have the
Although,
warning on the label, right? That was a thing with smoking too, right? Where you
that's
had to
right.
start putting the warnings on there. And then these kind of, in Europe at least, these awful pictures of what it looks like to have lung disease and stuff would be like on the, I guess it still is, on the cigarette pack.
Yeah, you could imagine if you were at a gas station and you fill up and you had shown pictures of future people that you harmed.
Yeah, or if you could
That
see
would be.
exactly, oh, this amount of gas leads to this and this and this, almost like at when you're shopping and you see where the produce came from. I don't know what the equivalent of that is, but some kind of way of tracing how much non-renewable resource you are now taking away from the earth and what you're putting into the future would be a very immediate way of starting to realize that your actions actually have consequences by
Yeah, it's true.
partaking in this.
Yeah, your question also raises just this kind of question of responsibility for it. As you mentioned this before too, about, so I'm still taking gas, I'm still using a lot of fossil fuel. Of course, some of my emissions are necessary for like breathing and that, but
Yeah.
others aren't. And so where's the So then you have these philosophers who say that you have no individual responsibility for climate change,
Can you give
who
the
reply.
example of that, the one that's used most for the individual not being responsible? That you could just go take a joyride in your car and it's not your fault.
That's right. Yeah. So you have a gas-guzzling SUV, and on a Sunday afternoon, you just go for a pleasant drive. And then I'm not an expert on this argument, but I think the kind of intuition behind it is that the kind of counterfactual, would there still be climate change if you didn't? do it? And the answer is yes. And if you say it's neither, your drive is neither necessary nor sufficient for climate change. But I don't like that argument at all, because it's, I don't know, it's weird. What caused climate change then, if not for all the individual contributions to this?
Absolutely. Is it Sinnoh Armstrong? Do you say Sinnott or Sinnoh?
Armstrong.
Okay, yeah, that's the one argument where I feel like I haven't read it actually in a long time, but I feel like there's a kind of sense of, yes, there's a group responsibility, but that doesn't mean individuals are responsible, which in the same way you just said, I find that really hard to buy. Of course, logically, you can create a logic argument that works, but I'm talking about in real life, like the way why is it either or, group or individual? And you can logically say, yes, that the individual didn't cause it, even if they're part of it, they didn't cause it, and you can separate it out in all these logical ways. But just in terms of this conversation and every day, it goes back to what you're saying about the smoking. It's always this more, it's not a linear thing. It's much more of complex system style thing that's going on, isn't it?
Yeah. But it does raise this interesting issue that I think you were getting at before, which I spent a lot of time last quarter teaching environmental ethics and talking to the students about this issue, which is, so I think Sinnoh Armstrong is wrong, and that I do have individual responsibility, and morally I need to get rid of my Volvo, and so I think that's on me, and I need to do that. On the other hand, a lot of my people point out, though, that there are these structural changes that individuals can't enact themselves, right? So here in the U.S., some cities and towns are going to community power versus their traditional electric. And sometimes those things are then 100% or very high 90% based on renewable. So here where I live, you can get the 100% renewable. But if I lived in a neighboring town, that's just not possible. And so could I really live? You just can't live without some power. And students will point out they can't partake in composting in the dorms if there is no composting program. That's not like you just invent one overnight by yourself. You can't. If you are taking the bus to school, whether the bus is gas or electric is... that's not up to you. You could vote and write letters or something, but
you could ride your bike. But if the streets are dangerous here, it's so easy to just walk in Holland, to walk wherever you want to go, or bike wherever you want to go, because the system is set up that way. But in the States, probably also for your students and places where they come from, you can't really walk. There's no sidewalks. And if you try to bike on the highway, you're going to get smushed. So like all of that is part of it too.
Yeah. And even like in the Netherlands, a lot of people live in cities that are not the city in which they work or go to school. And so then now you have to take the train. Maybe you stash a bike at each end, which I know often do there. But still, it's not up to you how the train is powered. Responsibility, at the train stop level, you can now choose to walk or bike as opposed to take a car. But it's a structural responsibility, really, the whole train system.
Yeah, and a lot of it's just historical inertia.
That's right.
If you don't have these options. But I think it's interesting how quickly things can change. And I think it goes back, I don't know what you think about this, but to what you were saying about it becoming cool or trendy. I don't know what that is. It'd be nice to dig around in that philosophically, like what happens when something becomes cool. But things do change quickly. Here, it's totally fine to take a bus and a train, for example. But I remember when I went to California, to LA, to visit friends, I thought, I'll try to take the bus just to try. And it was like, first of all, took all day for me to get from one side to the other if I was going to do it. And also, when you tell someone you're taking the bus, they're almost embarrassed for you or something. So I don't know. Maybe if all of this becomes cool, then, which it is starting to do, then you would have those changes where, for example, at the university, you have the option to compost, or cities are designed for bicycles but how do you see that like shift? Is it a shift of awareness of the possibility? Does it come from seeing it in movies and TV, or like people who others think are cool choosing those options? Or is it more a matter of what we were talking about at the beginning, this like real research oriented? I guess the answer is all of the above, but how do you see all that?
I was going to say all of the above, because I think some of it is the, you have this kind of, I don't know, threshold effect, it seems, you know, but a lot of it is economic, right? So if you think of, it's just unbelievable, the non-renewable advances and market, it's changed so fast. I haven't done it, but you know, you could probably look on Google and see what projections were for non-renewables 10 or 15 years ago. I'm sure they've underestimated, they're probably badly off, most of them. It's just so fast.
Yeah, I think the peak was really different.
Yeah,
I
and then
mean,
all of our
the
kind
change.
of social norms and all of that, then all will start to develop then as well. My neighbor got solar before me. I was horrified, you know, because
Yeah.
they don't even have the same politics as I do. I thought, oh my God, the opposite team is more green than I am. This is unacceptable.
Yeah, it's like keeping up with the Joneses or whatever from the 50s, but that becomes trying to be more sustainable, or it's also about making the things easier to access and cooler themselves. Like even thinking about how we design the electric bike, for example, that you were talking about, that's like a cool thing now. Or electric cars, Tesla created a cool looking car, or the brand itself also becomes something trendy. Yeah.
Are there any electric cars you like? You looked at one,
Did you
two
look
or
at
buying
one?
a car? Yeah.
I haven't really looked into buying one. I was gonna say earlier that I feel a little guilty because I work, I can advise like companies and stuff, but when it comes to actually owning an electric car, I haven't taken the step yet. Even renting an electric car, because I had to move all through Europe, I was nervous to rent the electric version because I wasn't sure yet about how to charge it, like when traveling.
There are places where there aren't so many charging stations.
But it's
I
getting
was
better, you know. Even on the GPS now, it says every little charging station, even when it's not a electric car. So that's part of it too, is how we change these kind of habits and so on. Do you feel like you have some sort of power or potential for changing this situation? You do, from my end, because you're working in a lot of groups at the university. You're a teacher that people respect. You're a philosopher, so you have a voice that people will listen to. But I wonder, in your own, like, we're talking about our own personal lives and how we still have these things we have to improve. How do you see all of that, like your role as a kind of a voice for these things? And then, you know, not getting the solar panels before your neighbor. Is that, do you think about those philosophically, that person group exchange?
yeah, it's so I don't well I don't think anyone really does try to divide a wall in their mind between the personal and their professional. But on the other hand, I have learned to just maybe I shouldn't have learned really, but just to go easy on myself, that you're not going to be perfect in any way, and that you could just do what you can to move the needle a little bit. And if lots of people move the needle a little bit, then the needle gets moved. And so if my personal life isn't completely caught up with my what I think, if, you don't get to redo your life. And just like, well, if I redid my life knowing what I know now, would I have bought this? Would I have bought that? Would everything would have been scrapped and massively changed, and that. But you don't really get to do that. And so there's inertia in your life that is hard to then
And
fight.
you can't change it, but you can change it in the present, though, and
That's right.
sounds.
Yeah. So going forward, you have now. Yeah. So I had those a certain understanding of climate crisis in 2014. Now I have a very different one. I'm not going to kill myself over the fact that I had that. Craig of 2024 now thinks Craig of 2014 was naive, and I'm not going to kill myself over that.
In fact, you could be glad that you see it differently. That's part
Yeah.
of, feels like part of the biggest shift is, I keep saying it in a way, this conversation, but it's a shift of how we think about it all. And in a way, once you've shifted that, you start shifting, helping others around you shift, and them, you too, of course, like your neighbors. And it's this kind of ongoing.
Yeah, and I'm lucky. I think in my main contribution is not actually through these committees and these policies, but just teaching the students I teach in the environmental ethics class are just, they're just so awesome. They're so clever. They've got more sophisticated understanding of things than I do, I think. And then so many of them go on and do really awesome things that I just see myself as like shepherding them out into the
Can you
world.
Give an example, or a more general example? Because that's something inspiring to think about.
Yeah, some of these students are just incredible. I wish more would keep in touch. Often people keep in touch with their high school teachers later in life, but they don't with their college professors. But yeah, there was one student in a Scripps Oceanography class that I would teach. She went on and helped create, she basically was the force of creating a marine preserve off an island in the Caribbean. She used her social science skills to survey fishermen, her diving and biology skills to figure out where would be the best location for this, and just being charming and energetic to move politicians. And I think before she was 30, she had created this marine preserve, which
That's
is
wonderful.
incredible.
That's a good, real change.
Excuse me. I give that example and then I immediately want to take it back because that's like putting too high a burden on anyone, I think, to be able to do something like that.
Well, it's just good to know what's possible. Everyone has their own interests. And
all of these students all the time, there were some that got compost bins into the Muir College. Some are real experts on campus climate issues on campus, and some with food issues and really pushing for better, greener transportation on campus. And so every class have like 40 in there, and probably 6 or 8 are doing something really pretty meaningful like that.
And those are huge shifts. If it reverberates, like there's a lot that happens off of those actions. But also, I just even talking to people for the show and stuff, maybe your students don't contact you, but a lot of people end up saying that it was a teacher who said one thing, or showed them one source, or happened to encourage them, or even just say what you just said, that wow, you have a lot of skill and you're doing great things. Because you don't get told that a lot when you're that age, even if you are doing amazing things. So it's amazing how much that shifts. Maybe you don't know, but just that you're recognizing that, and I think nurturing that, even if not explicitly, but just by your style and what you care about, it's a huge thing, I think. But you talk a lot about, so there's the fossil free research, which I mentioned, and this idea of trying to ban money coming from the fossil fuel research. Is that just for climate research, or is it all kinds of research?
Yeah, so there's this group called Fossil Free Research have called for. And so they have this letter. And so then that letter calls for a ban on from fossil, taking money from fossil fuel industry for climate research.
Climate research, okay. And how is that project going?
So I think it's got a lot of movement, but it also has a lot of controversy because people react, faculty react and say that it violates their academic freedom. And so you have a lot of pushback. And so right now, near you, VU Amsterdam implemented a kind of ban, and Princeton did, although they had to when they divested. And so they had some sort of weird rule that caused them to have to do this. And so they call it disassociation, and they disassociate from 90 companies. And then Brown University and a few other places are contemplating this. Some have studies going on, like Stanford. And so it is a kind of movement, but I haven't really pursued it. I've just pursued the transparency, because the actual funding ban is a much tougher sell at a university. And so I didn't really see any
Yeah,
chance
some of it
to.
feels like just raising the dialogue, even if there's controversy, it's just getting people to, it's one way that people start to realize that there is such funding going on. So hopefully the sunshine gets, there's more light will be put on where, what money is coming from. But there's two things I want to talk about, and then we can go. You just mentioned the academic freedom thing, and it's interesting because in your paper, which I'll link to, you talk about how this idea of academic freedom even started. And it was, I'm probably going to get this confused, but it seemed to be to keep corporate, to protect the institute from the corporation in a way. And then now it seems like it's the other way around, that now people are saying it's a matter of academic freedom to let the corporation influence the university. Is that right? Did I get that?
So it's a really weird about face, I think, because when, well, academic freedom has been around for hundreds of years in some form or other. But in the US, it was really the champion of it has been the American Association for University Professors. And in 1915, they put forth their proclamation of what academic freedom is. And immediately, they, so this was like these amazing philosophers like Dewey and
Yeah.
Lovejoy. And Lovejoy had come to Columbia from Stanford, where he quit in protest at Jenny Stanford's interference in
Interesting.
academic affairs. Anyway, one of the first cases they considered was this famous case where of Scott Nearing, who was an economist at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was super popular, but a good teacher, a good researcher, but he was progressive and he was arguing for regulations against child exploitation in employment. He was doing this in Pennsylvania, which employed the most, had relied, their economy relied the most on child labor of all the states
Oh, yeah.
then. And the trustees of the University of Pennsylvania were not happy.
So to
And
speak.
so they long had hated them, and then they eventually got rid of them. And so there you had these company, basically the companies were represented in as the trustees of the University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, there's
And
this
so
quote you
it's,
say where you couldn't really tell the boards apart. Somebody says the company
that's
board
right.
and the
Yeah, it's
university board have the
fantastic.
same people.
Upton Sinclair calls the University of Pennsylvania the University of UGI, United Gas Industry,
Right.
United Gas Improvement. And then UGI still exists now, and in fact, recently was, I was looking at what they're up to now, and they were recently exposed as having secretly funded some anti-solar,
Oh, still
anti-electrification
going then.
stuff. So now, but now, if you, yeah, so if so, academic free, so AAUP said Nearing's academic freedom was violated. And the whole idea of academic freedom was to protect somebody like Nearing from a company like UGI. Now, fast forward, and if a faculty member were told that they can't take a grant from UGI, they would say, well, my academic freedom is being
It's
done. So
almost,
it's not a logical contradiction, because you might
yeah.
want to say, well, companies shouldn't have the right to decide academic matters, like who's hired and who's fired and that. But can still take money from them. It's sort of awkward tension
Yeah.
because, yeah. And so in my paper, I have this argument that sort of Mill's argument that you can't use the liberty of free expression to give up your free expression. So
Right.
that because the very grounds for the liberty in the first place prohibit you from selling your liberty that way.
Right.
And so the idea is the same thing here, is that you can't use academic freedom as a ground to give up your freedom. You can't use academic freedom as an argument that you should take funding from a funder who's aiming to undermine the mission of the university, which is knowledge production for the social good.
Weirdly, though, we do it all the time, don't we? We use that argument. I'm free to let someone have my freedom in a way. I guess what I'm trying to get at is in the article, which is really interesting, you do talk about Mills and truth tracking. There's a lot of talk of truth and information, disinformation, misinformation. And I'm wondering about like how you see this relationship between freedom and truth. And because sometimes I felt like what we're talking about is truth, not freedom, Because if you're really free, you would know that there's disinformation that you're partaking in. So it's something like with the Volkswagen, for example, which we didn't really talk about, but you bought this car thinking it was clean diesel, and it was not clean. They were was diesel gated. They were tricking the emissions. So Luke Bovens wrote this article about that, and you can get into all this complexity about, okay, but maybe the emission standards were just way too high to try to keep diesel cars out, and diesel technology in Europe is different than here. And you can just go on and on about like ways to maybe think about Volkswagen is not completely evil. But at the end of the day, I felt like he was saying, but they lied and they knew they lied and it was the misinformation. And I was reminded of that too, reading yours, that there's something about what you described about Exxon. They knew this was going to happen and they said it wasn't going to happen. That seems like the problem. Is that freedom? What's the relationship?
Yeah, that's what I really want to target in the paper is disinformation. And so money will always affect things. Any money will affect anything, right? Any type of funding. And but this sort of active use of things in this kind of merchants of doubt tobacco strategy of disinformation, that I think. So what I try to do in the paper is that you have to walk this really fine line if you don't want it to conflict with academic freedom, is you don't want it to be that it becomes whether you can get funding for your research hangs on a kind of political litmus test. Because, okay, if you have the politics I do, then the fossil fuel industry isn't like a shining example of awesomeness. But you always have to imagine that different people have different political views. And this sort of any kind of policy you come up with could be then also used against you or against your personal interest in some way. And so the trick was, could I find something that is there something that these companies are doing that's wrong, where you could say it's wrong without saying that it's because of it's violating your conception of the social good. And so, yeah, on this kind of view, you again, I'm not pursuing this myself. I'm just going after the transparency. But if I were to go after this, then the way I would do it would be more the way Brown University is, where they're focusing on disinformation. Then on this kind of picture, then Big Solar, if Big Solar started doing became a merchant of doubt, doing disinformation, you could ban them too.
Yeah, because if it does become trendy that everything needs to be renewable, that's going to be a lot of power in those companies' hands. So,
And you're not banning Exxon because they're creating a climate crisis. The odd thing about the position, I guess, is that you're not banning them because they're helping create a climate crisis that will kill many, many people. You're banning them because of the disinformation
yeah.
tactics.
It relates to the sunshine and to the transparency too, doesn't it? Because that's the way you know if there's truth or not. If you have, because luckily we do have all of this record keeping that can't really quite be erased anymore. That's how Volkswagen got in trouble and a lot of people, because you can see, oh, you did know this at this time, even with what you were describing with Exxon. You can see in their research they did know it. You can't erase that anymore. So if there's transparency and people have easier access to look at that stuff, that disinformation argument, which seems really the only one we can really make because we're all so complicit in all of this stuff, that becomes really strong, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And knowing what's out there is then, since you know that the funding ends up can affect the research, then lets you search for that to see
Yeah,
if
you
there are
can find
bias there.
patterns that you wouldn't look for if you didn't have
Exactly.
all that. And you can also see clearly that there were things that could have that were just said falsely, presented in a false way. The same that we now see with the tobacco, but that d took all that time to see it, I guess.
The Volkswagen case is amazing because that stuff that David Michaels talks about, where they tried to produce evidence with that hideous experiment with these 10 monkeys sucking diesel gas. I think it was from this ancient old Ford. And then they was gonna look
What
at
can you
the.
what I didn't read the Michaels book totally. The one
Oh
the
yeah,
doubt
so
book, right? I haven't read that yet.
yeah,
I
so
just know it from all
Volkswagen
your
wanted
notes.
evidence that their clean diesel was healthy. So it wasn't producing as much nitrous oxide and related products that would irritate your lungs. So first they thought of having an, ex so they contracted with this company in New Mexico to run these experiments. And for the first idea was to actually run it with humans and have humans on exercise bikes, but then sucking diesel exhaust.
Oh my God.
And, but then presumably they decided because of a company with a long, whose deep history is connected to the Nazis, is not really good branding to have gassing with. And so they did it with monkeys. And then it's the weirdest thing. So they wanted to, so they didn't want to use a, so they wanted to use an old diesel, but they didn't want to use one of their old diesels. So they found some old, ancient old Ford pickup. I forget what year it was, but it's really old. They used that. Then they were going to use their, compare that then to their clean diesel. Volkswagen then had somebody come and help with the experiments to set things up, which of course is a kind of violation of normal scientific protocol, but basically to make sure the cheat device was on so that it wasn't actually emitting as much. And so they wanted to produce this data. And then the it's funny, really. Well, it's not funny because of the poor monkeys, but the clean diesel, even with the cheat device, ended up irritating the monkeys' lungs more than
Oh,
the old Ford.
really?
And so
Whoa.
even with evidence that they would even with an experiment with that, which they basically bought and
Cheated.
doctored, they get the wrong result. And so then they have all the testimony and emails where they're basically withholding payment to the New Mexico facility. And so they got the right result and published it. And
Wow. That is
so it was really super dishonest, but you see the lengths to which companies will go to manufacture evidence that they can then use.
Yeah, because of this growth economy model where we have to always, like, that's part of the system too, that we'll have to change in some way, that everyone's stuck on this. It must be what a company is. This must be what a corporation is. And you have to, the profit is the only thing that matters, and growth, and people can really quickly become like, just lose their ethics, can't they, in a system like that? It seems to be getting more and more distilled now that it's so much easier to become unethical in that system. I don't know what it is about that, but
yeah, it's just the profit above all. I don't know if you've ever looked, have you ever Googled? I just did one person yesterday, but Googled what happened to the, so Volkswagen tried to pin the blame on a member of their, some small number of their employees. And then where are they now? And so the first, one of the first people they tried to pin the blame on now is now today, like very high up, higher up than before. So
Oh
they
gosh.
suspended him pending an investigation, but he's obviously been rewarded for his willing to fall on the sword for the company to some extent. I wouldn't be surprised if most of them are.
Yeah, I think a few took a really hard blow, like the one guy who had to go to jail and stuff like that.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
otherwise, it just all, they just wait. This relates to your other philosophical topic of time. There's something
Yeah.
about time, you know. But let's not even go in there. But the Volkswagen thing is just painful, because to get to complicity again, it's very hard for me, because I wrote this book about the Volkswagen Beetle, and it's the story of the opposite of all of this, right? It's like that car's story is about transparency and thinking small, not keeping up with the Joneses, and like all this stuff. And that's what made them their name. And now it's just, I don't know, been used the other way. But before we go, because now we have been talking a lot, I feel like we've been talking really as if all these companies are terrible, and but they're actually made of people, and not all those people are bad. And it's much more nuanced, at least from my perspective, it's much more nuanced. It's much more of a culture that happens, especially at Volkswagen, that you become part of. And like, it's the system itself is just so unhealthy that you're unhealthy. I wonder how you see that, or are you more optimistic and you think, okay, all these car companies are starting to, even only because it's becoming trendy, they all have to make electric, even Volkswagen, and everyone's shifting, and maybe there's going to be some shift that then comes to our energy sources. I don't know. How do you see all that stuff?
Yeah, I definitely don't think of it as a kind of all or nothing thing at all. I do think that basically many of the big companies have shown again and again and again that they do view life as cheap if it doesn't hurt profits. And so they have opportunities for safety devices and things like that that they could put in but choose not to, because it's always the bottom line. But that doesn't mean everybody's working for the company is bad or anything like that. And then, so I often think of it from what's happening now is to, like before when I would, so I've taught environmental ethics for a long time. And so when you would think about the, and also I grew up in Rhode Island, all blue collar family and that, and you have these kind of skilled blue collar workers, often a particular town will be employed in particular ways. And so in Rhode Island, southern Rhode Island, there'd be a lot of fishermen and lobstermen. They then get hit heavily by the different regulations about overfishing. They, when they, probably when they started, they didn't realize, you know, they were contributing to the overfishing crisis. Or think of like on this coast, you think of like loggers in the Pacific Northwest. But and what really I find distasteful it was that if environmentalists just think, well, they need to get new jobs. Well, it's easy to say that, but it's actual people's lives. They might have been logging for many generations. That might be the only source of employment in the town. It's to say it casually, or that there should be some training programs for new skills or something like that. Well, yeah, there should be. They have a lot of that for coal, and a lot of the coal places trying to
the
reskill
mining.
the labor force. But to think of it as that, that's not a huge thing to ask of people, and you're not going to harm about a lot of people, and to think that they're evil because they were in that business when it just, it gets discovered before, well after they're already in that structure and in that system.
Yeah, where their life is built
maybe
around
it. Maybe they didn't even really have any good choices apart from that. And so to then all of a sudden condemn everybody who works in it is you know, really not thinking it through enough, I think.
Yeah, and I think that comes to, loops back to some of the themes in a nice way, because it is about this disinformation and truth and transparency and options. The more that is possible for people, the more they do have choices. And the, hopefully, the more we change these systems that, like the economic system, because really a lot of it stems from like the profit motive or needing to grow, or just on an individual level, you think you got to go to college and you got to get a job. And like the business, this kind of, these things that we assume have to be that way, like those maybe can start to shift too, the more we have truth and transparency. Because then you start to notice the systems, right? Like, I know you're not doing the fossil free research thing, but just like having that out there starts to make you look at the system in a way that you wouldn't before. Yeah.
Right.
From the outside.
Yeah, most people don't know that.
No, they don't think about it. The university seems like a church that's completely separate from all that, just if you, in a common day assumption, which is why you, they trust it if they hear Obama cite a scientific study.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another sort of motive is regaining trust in our work. And I think studies show, and but also just common sense shows, who do you trust more, somebody who was hiding something or somebody who just says, look, I've got an interest in such and such. Everyone trusts a second more.
Yeah, just that stance of taking that stance of even saying, okay, I'm not doing perfectly with all of this, but I see what I'm doing. That's an important stance. So, okay, so here's the last question. I don't know if you can connect it to all your years of teaching environmental ethics and so on, and what you've seen in terms of patterns of change, or what might be hopeful, or what you've seen that really, that young people respond to, or that the world responds to. But if you think about motoring, we're going to have some kind of movement, even if it's virtual. I don't know what we want to explore. We want to connect. There's some kind of motoring, even if it's our own bodies or something. this idea of ecological motoring from this kind of standpoint that we've been talking about, how can you like how would you see that?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a good answer, as I mean, we're never going to get motoring with strict forever because ultimately we run up against physics. But you know, in a more realistic sense, we can imagine a world where there's always going to be a kind of a problem, I think. So if we go completely electric, then of course there's the battery issue, and then you might imagine new materials for batteries being discovered, and then those being depleted and there being issues, and then move on to another one and another one and another one. Where is that? But we're not going to have kind of unbounded resources for the long run. We might have effectively unbounded resources in that way, or at least if you mean by ecological, it could be increasingly more ecologically friendly means of motoring for a long, 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 long time, I think.
Yeah. I guess you think the universe is finite, right? So
Well, even if it's infinite, probably we won't have access to, well, I don't know how long
resources.
we'll be around anyway, but
Yes, we won't have forever, but I guess there could be some kind of motoring or some kind of powered movement for whatever
yeah.
forever means, but we don't know. But that would be another conversation. Well, thanks for your writing and for the work you're doing, and thanks for talking to me about all these things. It's really helpful to get your perspective, so I appreciate it.
Oh yeah, thanks very much. It's been really a pleasure.